Medicaid, forcing nearly 16 million Americans to lose their health insurance coverage. Meanwhile, the Senate parliamentarian has advised several key proposals violate procedural rules, including GOP plans to gut funding for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and slash SNAP food aid spending, putting the cost burden to states. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
We know that if only four Republicans went to Leader Thune and said, we can't vote for this bill with these Medicaid cuts, some of the cuts, at least, would be eliminated.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said the central bank will not cut interest rates and instead will wait to see how the economy evolves. He cited President Donald Trump's tariffs in the decision. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s new vaccine advisory panel is meeting for the first time today, discussing COVID-19 shots. Though no recommendation is planned, Kennedy fired 17 previous members, and his replacements include anti-vaccine voices and conspiracy theorists, including Dr. Robert Malone, who has previously said COVID-19 vaccines can cause a form of AIDS. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features DR Congo-Rwanda Agreement Contextualized. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Natty Congo by Bukan Guinea, commemorating Caribbean American Heritage Month. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all the folks who were able to join us this past Sunday, June 22nd, at the Jazz and Justice Festival Art in the Park, presented by WPFW in collaboration with Washington Parks and People at the Malcolm X Park on Meridian Hill. It was great meeting you all, a true family reunion. Last week on June 20 was World Refugee Day. Due to the continued external destabilization of the country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, has nearly 7 million people who have been displaced. And since the late 1990s, over 6 million people have been killed in the country due to the conflict. Recently, we've seen the Rwanda-backed armed group M23 control towns in the eastern part of the DRC. The DRC and nature of the agreement, the missing issue of justice for Congolese people in the agreement, the continued external destabilization by the US and other Western countries, the continued neocolonial role of multinational corporations who are exploiting the DRC's vast resources, the massive loss of life, and more. The bully is an analyst at the Kinshasa and is former national spokesperson for the Friends of the Congo. He is a human rights advocate and is one of the leading political and cultural Congolese voices. Here is my conversation yesterday with Kambale Musavuli, who, as I mentioned, is speaking to us directly from Accra. Kambale Musavuli, welcome back to the show. Thanks. There's so much we have to discuss in the now. Before we get constantly about the DMLD packet.
In the Congo, in a bit, through, I'd argue, 3.830. And the Congo, an invasion of two of its neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, were U.S. allies on the so-called war of terror, who are also playing almost as the key agent on the African continent for some of Western interest on the African continent. So these two countries, Rwanda and Uganda, invaded the Congo in 1996 and in 1998. And since 2002, after the formal signing of the so-called peace accord, they've continued to support proxy rebel militias. When you look at the Congo, in the press, they will tell you that Congo has over 100 rebel groups. It's a mess. You don't know what's going on. It's about minority groups being oppressed and so on. But as you look at it much closely, you start wondering, how come Congolese are dying in millions? The estimated number of the deaths, the conservative number, is 5.4 million people from 1998 to 2007. We are in 2025. So we know that over 6 million Congolese people have died in this conflict. But when we see the deaths, what we see at the same time as the death is the continuous pilfering of Congo's mineral resources. And the minerals have not stopped flowing out of the DRC. The coltan that's used in your cell phone, the cobalt in your electric cars and batteries, right? The lithium, one of the largest lithium reserve in the world is in the city called Kolwezi, where they've just inaugurated a top-notch international airport this month, where minerals are flying out of Kolwezi, but Congolese people are still dying. So I'm clear, as we try to break down the situation in the Congo, it's really important for people to know that the conflict there is really about control of Congo's mineral wealth and the mineral wealth needed in the fourth industrial revolution that we are all experiencing with the advance of AI and advance of technology. So that's the simplification of what is happening. And that has been the story of the Congo, right? At the Berlin Conference, 1884-85, Western nations sat down to cover up the African continent. But the question was, what are we going to do with the DRC, the land that we call the DRC today? In order for them not to fight each other over control of that land, they gave it to King Leopold. And why did they want the land back then? They needed the rubber that was used for the tires of the cars, right? And today, in 2025, this is the same discussion that we are having. Who is going to control Congo's cobalt, Congo's copper, Congo's lithium for the fourth industrial revolution? Unfortunately, Congolese are dying and paying the price. And we do have African agents in Kigali and Kampala who have facilitated this exploitation, causing mass deaths in the DRC since 1996.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the number of people who have died, I think it's estimates show it a little over 6 million. I've seen figures like that, as well as the last week, it was on June 20th was the day for World Refugee Day. And Congo has one of the highest internal displaced population. It's like nearly 7 million people have been displaced from all these conflicts. And as you mentioned, this is the heart of it has been the taking of the resources from the continent, like the conference you mentioned in 1884-85 in Berlin, which was where the continent was carved out. But the heart of it was actually, the Congo Conference, actually, initially, or something like that, at the heart of it. And so we go, it seems like we're history is repeating itself again. As history is repeating itself, what has been the announcement last week from in Washington that there's going to be the signing of the agreement between the DRC and Rwanda on June 27th? What has been the reaction on the ground of Congolese people? Has it been one of surprise or one of excitement or whatever? What has been the general mood?
I don't think any reasonable Congolese is celebrating this agreement to be signed for a few reasons. One of them first is the lack of transparency to what is being signed. A lot is being said to the press. They've signed a declaration of principles that is non-binding, in my view, and they're going to sign an agreement where in the press it states that the United States will have access to $2 trillion dollar worth of minerals, which is about one tenth of Congo's mineral wealth, you know, estimated at $24 trillion, right? No country in the world today has access to one tenth of Congo's minerals. The only country that will have that if it's signed with what is being reported would be the United States. But as I pointed before, we have to analyze how we got here, right? Congo has been destabilized for the past three decades by two of Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, which I insist are U.S. allies. So what they're doing in DRC, they cannot do it without the United States being aware of it. And there have been documentation from 96 to present. Even most important reports on the situation in the Congo is the report that we call the UN Mapping Exercise Report, calling what's happening in the Congo war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possible genocide if proven in a competent court, singling out Rwanda for committing genocide in DRC, right? So the documentation on the killings in the Congo, on the perpetrator, who's causing the chaos, exists. But we've seen for three decades the unwillingness of the United States to hold these allies accountable for crimes they commit. But since 2021, the rebel group that is calling the press M23 started another uprising, right? And they've operated in the Congo under different names. In 1996, they were called AFDL. In the 2000s, they used two names, right? One was RCD, and then later CNDP. After 2012, they start calling themselves M23. So for someone reading the news today and hear M23, they get lost in the history of the conflict. It's literally the same rebel group that has been causing chaos in DRC for about 30 years, right? And they were defeated militarily thanks to SADC forces, the Congolese military, and also international pressure at the time in 2012 under the Obama administration, whereby they ran away from DRC, completely disappeared, and reappeared in 2021. So what took place in 2021? In 2021, there were a lot of trade agreements and cooperations taking place between the DRC and countries in the Eastern African bloc, particularly Kenya and Uganda. Building of roads, building of infrastructure, and trying to boost trade. And for some very mysterious reason, the M23 appeared while these deals are taking place. Not that I support these deals in any shape, but it's important to understand the context in which they reappeared. But as they reappeared, they used the same narrative they've been using for 30 years, that the DRC government has not implemented the 2009 accord that they signed with them. They have not been integrated well. And they are back also to protect a minority group in the DRC, the Tutsi minority group, as they always present every time they come. So for an outsider listening to this, when you start hearing that, you hear even the term Tutsi, you hear about minority group, you start connecting the conflict in the Congo to what happened in Rwanda in 1994, right, with the Rwandan genocide. And that's problematic because in the Congo, a country of 400 ethnic groups, almost every ethnic group is a minority. So we do not have the same issue. But it helps for the propaganda of the M23 to use the narrative. But the facts on the ground, what we saw is they start taking town after town. They took over Bunagana. They still have control of Bunagana. And they kept moving. As they are taking over the town, they were not moving where the minority ethnic group is. What they were doing was they were moving where the mines are. So they start taking over town where you have huge mineral exploration and exploitation as well, right? One of the towns that took over is Rubaya. Rubaya has the largest coltan mine in the world. The Rubaya mine you could literally connect many of the electronic devices around the world and say that there is a high chance, from 12 to 30% chance, that what you have in your phone comes from that mine in DRC. They took control of that mine, and according to the UN group of experts, they were making, not from the exploitation, right, of the minerals, but for taxing miners in the area, they were making $800,000 a month as they are fighting the Congolese military. So I'm pointing that out to show how is it that the rebel group says they are fighting for a minority group, but they are connected to a mineral exploitation where they're making close to $1 million a month on taxing people. And I believe Global Witness published a report documenting also how the minerals from the Rubaya mine from the M23 hands transit through Kigali and found its way into a Luxembourg company, right? That documentation exists. But as all of this have unfolded, and as the conflict on the ground from 2021 to now morphed with more alliances of people who are against the Tshisekedi regime, the Tshisekedi regime became desperate in stopping the advance of the M23 because they were taking town after town, and you wake up one day, you hear ex-politician in the DRC political scene has joined the M23. That militarily, the Congolese military was not able to stop the advance of the M23. Why weren't they able to stop them? We know today, thanks to UN Group of Experts reports, intelligence report that's been published, and even an NBC investigation in the United States showing video evidence that the Rwandan military, up to 7,000 soldiers, are currently in the DRC fighting alongside with the M23. And when you see the sophisticated weapon that they have, night vision goggle, surface-to-air missile, anti-drone radar, all these military equipment documented very well in reports and in the documentaries that have been released in the past few months, you wonder how come the Western world is not taking decisive action. They've been slapping the wrist. You know, the United States government has sanctioned Rwandan generals. One of them, James Kabarebe, is being sanctioned. And when you read the sanction in the OFAC page, the Treasury Department, you will notice that they mentioned that he's been active in DRC for the past 29 years, which means that the U.S. government has known that this Rwandan general supporting the M23 over the past three decades has been active, but only now an action has taken place. So this is the backdrop. The Congolese government, inadequate to stop the M23, decided through the president's office, not Tshisekedi's office directly, to send an emissary to Washington, D.C., to ask Donald Trump to help in this situation. Very fascinating, right? Willingly, the Congolese president sent an emissary to cut a deal. This emissary, Mr. Lubeya, came to Washington, was able to get a letter to Trump where the offer was, we will provide Congo's mineral resources in exchange of the support of the United States to bring about peace and stability. And they played on the context, right? The geopolitical context, whereby the United States today wants to counter China on the African continent. China in the DRC control up to 80% of the critical minerals mines in DRC. Not because they assassinated a leader, not because they imposed the government on Congolese. This is through trade, right? They've been able to purchase the mines. There are concerns on some of the sales, but one of the biggest sales that they actually did was even with an American company, Freeport-McMoRan, right? Freeport-McMoRan, which owned the largest copper and cobalt reserve in the world in the DRC, sold their mine in the DRC to the Chinese to the tune of $2 billion, right? So it's important to contextualize even what the Chinese are doing. But because of the request from the Congolese president and Trump being interested into this deal, the U.S. government has engaged in what they call peace negotiation. They are going through also Qatar, and lately they are really the face of the deal itself, because they will be signing of the deal, if I'm not mistaken, on June 27. The U.S. is being presented in the media as the savior of the Congo, erasing the history of interference in DRC, erasing the support of Congo's neighbors who have been destabilizing, and presenting it just as a commercial deal, while on the Congolese side, to go now to your question, what are Congolese saying? That the miners have already put out statement in the Katanga province, in the civil society, put out a statement that they are against any deal with the United States. Well, there was no consultation with the Congolese people. Now, this deal that's being signed has not gone to the Congolese parliament. There has not been consultation with the Congolese people. That we are hearing in the press that this is being signed. So we know because of the context in which it's being signed, the fact that there is lack of transparency, we don't know what the clauses are, the fact that there was no consultation of the Congolese people, we do not believe that will actually bring peace and stability in DRC. I want to know, I wish someone will actually let me know, which country the United States has helped have peace in the world. If we have empirical evidence that the U.S. has successfully done such things, then we can believe that this could work. But from the Congolese perspective, any peace deal that happens in the Congo that does not take into account the question of justice, because we've had millions of Congolese who have died, and the perpetrator of the violence are known. They are local, regional, and international players, particularly Congo's neighbors. If we are not talking about holding people to account for the crimes they committed, we are not solving the problem of the conflict in the Congo. And that's where the Congolese civil society stands at the moment, as we are all witnessing pretty much the stealing of Congo's future through this deal without consultation with the Congolese people themselves.
And again, that's Kambale Musavuli, and he is an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa, and we're dissecting, conceptualizing the recent announcement of the DRC-Rwanda agreement, which will be signed right now, planned to be signed on June 27. I wanted to unpack several things you brought up in that backdrop of the agreement, or we should say even forefront of the agreement, particularly the issue of the minerals and some of the countries involved, the United States and Qatar. But first, I want to expand a bit more on the minerals connection. And that's been always been the backdrop or the front end of issues concerning the DRC from independence and even pre-independence when European colonization took place. Because you had corporations have always been in the background, or well, we say in the background, but really at the heart of some of these movements politically, because even when in the independence, when the secession of Katanga province at that time was pushed by corporations. Where do you see the corporations? You've mentioned some of them. If you've had any information lurking in this particular agreement, you've had mineral concessions, but are they corporations really at the heart of it in pushing the agreement? Because they want to get the minerals for the new technologies.
In my humble 15 to 20 years advocacy work, I have not seen the type of engagement of American companies when it comes to DRC as I'm seeing now. We are literally having Silicon Valley companies contacting us to analyze the Congo and speaking about how can they move to the continent and invest in the continent. It's fascinating. And there have been about 3 to 4 groups with whom we've had discussions. And whenever I share with them that specific question of justice, they do not have an answer for that because they are moving in for investment. They're not moving in for justice for the Congolese. So that's one level. But on what is on the record that people can pull out, people should know that Bill Gates was just in DRC. Right? And Bill Gates in DRC, by the time he left, he signed a deal. Right? Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, they have a company called Cobalt Metals that operates in Zambia and in DRC, specializing in extraction of lithium. Right? And the operation, which is also quite fascinating, is that it's an AI-driven mineral exploitation company. They're using artificial intelligence to find where to mine. The same minerals that is being used to power the technology is what they are using now to make even more money. So what did Bill Gates do? Him flying, he met the president of the Congo, and he signed a deal also in DRC of $1 billion to get access to one of the largest reserves of lithium in the world, in the Manono mine. That's just one company I'm speaking about. I can go and speak about Elon Musk, who has just seen his license for Starlink approved, and now he's operating, collecting data of Africans, because there have been a few African countries, even here in Ghana, people are questioning the, how can I put it? He has almost a free access to Africa's data where many African governments are not holding him accountable for how he uses the data. Starlink, according to a few articles that's been published online, has already been exposed for getting contract on the African continent thanks to the State Department. And I can go on and on. That I know American companies are salivating this opportunity, but they're not looking at transforming the lives of the Congolese. They're not looking at stopping the killing. They're looking at how do we counter China, through the Lobito Corridor, be it through this peace security deal, minerals deal swap, and not even talking about the bettering of the Congolese people from a concrete perspective. But another element to even think about outside of the companies and the corporations is to really make a comparison of who is colonizing Africa. And this is very important.
You're listening to a recent conversation with human rights advocate Kambale Musavuli, who's an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo-Kinshasa. In the conversation, he's dissecting and contextualizing the recent proposed DRC-Rwanda peace agreement scheduled to be signed on June 27 in Washington, D.C. The music in the background is Sun Goddess by Earth, Wind & Fire, and we play that commemorating summer solstice, which was on June 20 here in the Northern Hemisphere, and commemorating Black Music Month or African American Music Month. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
Right, because we hear a lot about China colonizing Africa with the exploitation. I'm very fascinated by the fact that right now, we're not saying that the United States is colonizing the Congo. Why am I saying that? Because it's very, if we use the same logic that the Western world has have used for calling China the imperialist power, the new colonizer, when the deal, right, the deal of the century, they even called the deal of the Chinese in the DRC the deal of the century. And the deal of the century for China in DRC was $9 billion. Not trillions, $9 billion. That was the initial amount. So if we call that the deal of the century, how do we call the $2 trillion deals, knowing U.S. interference in Congo's politics from Lumumba to now, even from the Berlin Conference to now, the assassination of Lumumba, the imposition of dictators, the looting of our resources, that now they are coming to get $2 trillion from us? That could be even something worse than a deal. So it's also important to understand the geopolitics that the corporations are going to be involved in the context of the United States. The U.S. military is going to be involved because that's also the request. But even with the U.S. military being involved, it makes it appear as if the U.S. military was not involved before. They have done med flag training in DRC. They have been training Congolese military in Kisangani and in different military camps across the Congo. We have not seen peace. What now we are observing is that Eric Prince, the former CEO of the company Blackwater, I think they have a new name now, he's working to bring American mercenaries to the DRC. He has an insurance company, and he's also into mineral exploitation. So the Bill Gates, the Eric Prince, the Elon Musk, all of them are coming into the DRC while the Congolese are still screaming. We have a UN report that calls what's happening in the Congo war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possible genocide if proven in a competent court, that we are calling for the creation of an international tribunal so that those who have committed these crimes, be it in the Congo or outside, can be arrested and tried so that people can come to a closure of losing millions of their loved ones. That's where the Congolese people are fighting. Not having these billionaires flying in and trying to make a quick buck on the back of the Congolese people.
I'm glad you said that when you're just unpacking the role of the corporations, that this is not a new thing. Because as we said before, right from the beginning, even at the Berlin Conference, it was the U.S. that supported King Leopold. To get that to access Congo, it was the U.S. backing that, and so this is really a continuation of U.S. multinational corporations' continuous exploitation of the Congo, and as you mentioned, the military in the 70s as well, supporting Mobutu Sese Seko. Twice when they visibly supported when they went into the what was then it was called Shaba province, but then now it's it was in Katanga province. It was the Shaba One, Shaba Two, and so it's really the continuation of the as you mentioned the colonization of or neocolonization policies of the United States in this deal. Do you see that? Is that an accurate reflection of this, at least on the surface of this pending agreement?
Absolutely, and there are so many comparisons or parallels we can draw from the Berlin Conference. You know, the acts or the actions of Congolese President Tshisekedi are similar to the acts of tribal chiefs who signed papers from Henry Morton Stanley. Right, because he was on the ground, he went and collected papers where people gave him land. They didn't know what they were signing. But this is the paper that was used to justify that this land, the size of Western Europe, would belong to King Leopold. When you read the Declaration of Principles and also what has been mentioned in the press about this deal that's going to be signed, it appears that Rwanda is still part of Congo's mineral trade, because they're saying that the minerals of the Congo will still be refined, will still transit through Kigali. That reminds me again of King Leopold, right? The U.S. didn't control the Congo, but they allowed King Leopold to control the Congo. The same thing now. Donald Trump does not want to directly control the Congo, so he still is relying on Paul Kagame to come at the side. And in the end, after the signing of this deal, or if you go back to the Act of Berlin, the voice of the Congolese people is not included. I mean, do you know that right now, even in Rwanda, right, the Rwanda civil society and the opposition forces, they actually put out a statement this week against this deal. Because they said that if you are going to include Rwanda, where is the voice of the Rwandan people themselves?
Yeah, and they even arrested one of the former presidential candidate.
Indeed, Ingabire.
Yeah. Right, Ingabire. Again, arrested again. Yeah.
So when you see that, what is becoming very clear is that we are witnessing the Berlin Conference happening now, with some African faces participating in the process, but the African people have no say. What is even more deplorable at the moment is that many Africans are clueless about what is happening in the Congo. The biggest stake of the 21st century, right? The geopolitics of the 21st century is being played right now in the heart of our African continent, in the Congo. Whoever is going to control Congo's cobalt, Congo's lithium, and Congo's copper will have the military supremacy during the Fourth Industrial Revolution that we are all mostly speaking about, the AI and what it does and how it helps. We're not even discussing that executives of some of these tech companies, right, like the Palantir, the OpenAI, and Meta AI, have become lieutenant colonels of the U.S. Army, right? According to the U.S. military press release, U.S. Army press release that came out on June 13th, that this technology being now used in the military, in the U.S. military, with the support of tech executives becoming colonels of the U.S. Army, cannot function without Congo's minerals. And most Africans are not even discussing that. And that's why it's so important, at least now, keep assisting with young people with whom we work. He said, we need to study, we need to read. We have to find out why Kwame Nkrumah was very agitated about the Congo, that Congo needed to be free. Why Fanon in Toward an African Revolution, that's the title of the book, Toward an African Revolution, that the last sentence of that book is, let us never forget it, that the fate of Azali is at stake in the Congo. And the same thing is happening now, that the fate of Africa is being played and may be strongly at stake on June 27, 2025, but most Africans are not even aware that this is actually the play of the West at a critical moment where some African countries are taking a sovereign posture, like in the Sahel, and saying no to the U.S. military. An African president, like Tshisekedi, saying, yes, come and take the minerals. Those are things that people who want to see a free and liberated Africa, a free world, a world without wars, should pay attention that this deal that they are signing does not represent the interests of the Congolese people. It's among the elite of the Congo who want to preserve power. It does not address peace nor security, but it's a commercial deal only to counter China, where the U.S. will benefit from it and not the people of the Congo nor the African continent.
Again, that's Kambale Musavuli. He He's an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo-Kinshasa. He's speaking to us directly from Accra, and we're dissecting the current Rwanda-Congo agreement that's been announced, that's going to be signed on the 27th of June, apparently. And we wanted to dissect it further to see what it really meant. And as you mentioned, the agreement and the role of the military, and this is just as it, we just keep history just keeps repeating itself. And as we mentioned, the how Congo has been very much instrumental in some of the developments in industrially, but also on the military side. We're looking at sadly the two bombs that were dropped in Japan and in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those minerals came from Congo, the uranium from Congo, which most people don't realize that that was at the heart of even the assassination of Lumumba, to have that control of the minerals, the uranium there. And now we're coming back again over 50 years, over 60 years. We're back at the same place where you have the industries controlling with certain agents. And the geopolitics is very interesting because you also have, as you mentioned, in the continent, there's the seemingly lack of leadership on this issue, looking at how Congo has played an important role on destabilizing the continent, destabilizing Congo, so you destabilize the rest of the continent as well. Because the role of the AU, the African Union, where are they in this discussion? And because, as you mentioned Nkrumah. Nkrumah was very vocal at the time of the when there was colonial powers were trying to destabilize Congo right at the independence. You had people like Nkrumah, people like, you know, NASA and others speaking out. But where is the AU today?
The AU
African Union.
Yeah, but the AU is not the OAU. What you're referencing is the OAU, Organization of African Unity. We've come from NSR. As I was already very concerned when the OAU changed its name to AU. I was concerned when the African Union decided to change Africa Liberation Day to Africa Day, because the reason why...
Yeah, taking out the word liberation.
But it was a call to action, right? If Africa Liberation was a call to action that the founding fathers and mothers of OAU worked on and to make sure that Africans know that the struggle continues, that you decide to remove that word, we should ask ourselves that question. What happened to the liberation? Because the liberation is incomplete. We are still fighting for liberation. So it's hard for me to be a spokesperson of the African Union. I do not work for the African Union. I don't have any connection at the African Union. But I do see that a lot of young people, ordinary people across the African continent, they are very clear that the AU today does not represent the interest of the African people. And the way we can see that is the silence of the AU when it comes to rigged election, when it comes to corrupt practices in some countries, right? But they are very quick to condemn a coup that doesn't serve their interest. So, for example, we saw what happened to Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, not just with ECOWAS, but also with the AU. But we are very clear that the people on the ground, the masses, the ordinary African, they see something new being born of the alliance of Sahel states. Now, these countries, they have their own contradiction. They have their own internal contradiction that they are working through. But it's giving hope to Africans to say that we actually can be sovereign. We can decide to have our own currency. We can decide to remove foreign military bases from our countries. AU is not working toward that, right? It's not necessarily helping with the aspiration of the ordinary African everywhere else. So there need to be not just a reform of the AU, because there have been many attempts to reform it. We need a new institution or a new wave of independence. And that's usually what the way I frame it, that there were Africans from the early 1900s to the 1960s, they organized to be able to have many African countries gain political independence. That was the victory of the past century. In the 21st century, the new wave has to be our second independence movement. And the second independence movement is around economics, right? The economy, the wealth, right? So we need an economic independence whereby, for example, in Ghana, the Ghanaian people can choose to work financially with anyone they choose rather than going to the IMF every time they get a loan of over $50 million. Can you imagine Ghana, with the gold that it has, cannot get a loan of over $50 million without board approval of the IMF, of people sitting in Washington, D.C., right? That means that they're not economically independent. And many African countries also are in the same situation. So fighting for that, we have to lift up the struggles that are moving forward, where, you know, as I continue to say, with their own contradiction in the Sahel state, that the Alliance of Sahel States has shown us that African countries can decide to choose what is good for their own people and tell the Western world, this is now what we need. But if you need us, if you need to work with us to build hospitals, we'll work together. If you need us to build a tomato paste factory, we'll work together. If you need us to have a joint venture for mineral exploitation that benefit the people, we'll work together. But if you want to have your military base in our country where we can't even enter the military base, we do not know what you do, please pack your bags and leave. And if more and more Africans are doing that, there won't be a need for the AU in its current configuration, which is seen by most Africans as a college of dictators protecting one another rather than serving the interests of the African people.
And what are your final thoughts, closing remarks, as particularly what are the Congolese grassroots organizations' points that they would like to see to be like people outside Congo to be in solidarity with them?
We must make the Congo crisis a Pan-African problem. That's the only way to solve this problem. The forces at play keeping Congo in bondage are not only inside of the Congo, but they operate at the international level. They operate even at the regional level. That every African and people of with free will who want to see a liberated world must organize wherever they are, the same way we organize to stop the apartheid regime, to do the same for DRC. It's a country with 120 million people, half of the population under the age of 18, $24 trillion worth of resources. But the most important resources are the 50% of the population, right? These young people, right? We're talking about 60 million people about under the age of 18, an engine to transform their African continent, if it is at peace and if it is at the hands of Africans, right? That's, I think, is the most important call, to make it a Pan-African problem. I used to think it was a language issue because Congo, you know, people speak in French, so it's very hard for people to understand. But I cannot say that anymore after I see how people, even in other languages, right, in Anglophone and Lusophone spaces, are able to understand what's happening in Burkina Faso and Niger and Mali. That I said that there must be a Joseph Conrad syndrome that is in the minds of the people, that whenever they hear the Congo, they may not see us as human beings. They may not see us as Africans. They may not see us as people who deserve attention. And when we are at that level, this is why such deals can happen, because no one is paying attention to what's happening in the Congo. So we must make it a central discussion in the coffee shops, in the universities, in the streets, radio, newspaper, everywhere, that we must fight for the liberation of the Congo, and it's so essential for the African people and free and liberated people around the world. And the last point, for people who want to be engaged, please go to freecongo.org, freecongo.org, you fill out the form, and different volunteers who work within the large network of Friends of the Congo and other allies will help you tap into organizations on the ground making impact. You know, from the André Blouin Center in Kinshasa to Yole Africa, Goma, to the Basenja Coalition with frontline defenders for climate change in the DRC, you will see exactly what Congolese people themselves are doing. And we hope that you will lift up our voice as we continue to call for the one single thing that we believe is the most crucial for peace and stability: justice. Justice, justice. So join us, freecongo.org, and we'll continue to fight for a free and liberated Congo.
Kambale, thank you very much for being on the show with us again.
Thank you, always.
You've just been listening to a recent conversation with human rights advocate Kambale Musavuli. Kambale Musavuli is an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa. In the conversation, Kambale Musavuli was dissecting and contextualizing the proposed peace agreement between the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, and Rwanda, which is scheduled to be signed on June 27. And a program note, next week on July 2nd, there'll be a special program looking at the legacy of Patrice Lumumba. July 2nd would have been Patrice Lumumba's 100th birthday. The music in the background is Summer Madness by Kool & the Gang, and we play that commemorating Black Music Month or African American Music Month, and also the beginning of summer here in the Northern Hemisphere. That's it for African Hour for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana with Zena Numin, looking at issues in the Middle East and Northern Africa. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor. Check out African Hour on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's African Hour Online. Also, African Hour is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under African Hour Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Clea Chapman. Thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Edison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, June 25th. Here are some headlines. A ceasefire between Iran and Israel appears to be holding today, with President Trump speaking at a NATO summit, said that the United States and Iran would hold talks. It is unclear what format the discussions would take or if they would lead to limits on Iran's nuclear program. Meanwhile, Trump continues to hail the American strikes on Iran as a success. The president said late Saturday that Iran's key nuclear sites were, quote, completely and fully obliterated, close quote. Yet there is significant skepticism about whether he actually achieved that objective. Speaking yesterday to reporters, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said, quote, "There's zero evidence that I've seen that the nuclear program was completely and totally obliterated, as Donald Trump has claimed. no evidence that has been presented to Congress to suggest that has occurred, close quote. And an early U.S. intelligence assessment that was described to CNN by sources briefed on it said the U.S. strikes on three of Iran's nuclear facilities did not destroy the core components of its nuclear program and likely only set it back by months. CNN reports the assessment was produced by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency and is based on battle damage assessment conducted by the U.S. Central Command after the U.S. strikes. In other news, dozens continue to die each day as violence in IDF-occupied Gaza continues. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Gaza's Civil Defense Agency said Israeli forces killed another 46 people waiting in line for aid in the Palestinian territory yesterday. 21 people were killed and around 150 wounded by Israeli fire near an aid point in central Gaza, and another 25 were killed in a separate incident in south Gaza. The deaths are the latest in a wave of violence near aid distribution points established by the controversial Israel and U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. U.N. agencies have condemned the food distribution system, with one official calling it, quote, a death trap, end quote. The Guardian said yesterday that the latest attack brings the total death toll from such attacks in the past 2 weeks to over 500 people. Critics of Netanyahu have accused him of planning the wide-scale eviction of Palestinians by forcing them into inhuman conditions. The aid flowing into Gaza has been insufficient for months, and the IDF continues to cordon off Palestinians into smaller and smaller pockets of territory. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, Zohran Mamdani, a 33-year-old state assembly member and Democratic Socialist in New York, is on the verge of a major upset in the race to be New York City's next mayor. Mamdani, a Democratic Socialist, declared victory in the Democratic primary last night, defeating his main rival, Andrew Cuomo, who conceded the race. The final tally will not be known until next week due to New York's ranked choice voting system that allows citizens to choose up to five candidates in order of preference. Mamdani's campaign focused on affordability, an issue he raised again in a victory speech last night.
We have won because New Yorkers have stood up for a city they can afford. A city where they can do more than just struggle. One where those who toil in the night can enjoy the